The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Even before Roe v. Wade was overturned, Texas had one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. And after Roe fell, Texas went further with multiple laws that made nearly all abortions illegal.
We'll take a look at this crowd. Thousands are here at City Hall for the Houston Women's March. Here for many issues, but the biggest being the fight for abortion rights.
The mother's health is also deteriorating, and doctors have told them in this situation, most would choose to terminate the pregnancy. However, under Texas law, that is no longer an option.
Emotional testimony from women in a Texas courtroom today saying the state's abortion ban put their lives in danger.
I had just been given the worst news of my life.
Stefania Talladreed has been reporting for The New Yorker about the abortion fight in Texas.
A woman has to be, and I'm going to cite the law here, at risk of death or of substantial impairment of a major bodily function.
But that exception is not at all clear-cut. And doctors who are threatened with all kinds of penalties very often don't know what to do. Two lawsuits have been brought against the state of Texas by women for injury after they were denied abortions. Stefania Talladreed cited the case of a woman with cancer who couldn't receive chemo or radiation treatment because of her pregnancy. Cases like those led to an unlikely collaboration between two Texas legislators, one an advocate of reproductive choice and another who helped write an abortion ban. Steph, you've been reporting in great depth on abortion and anti-abortion bills since before the Dobbs decision. You talk with a state representative named Ann Johnson, who comes from Houston, and she was instrumental in this.
So the first thing that you should know about Ann Johnson is that she's a Democratic member of the House in Texas. She was elected in 2020, and she represents the Medical Center in Texas. It's home to some of the largest and leading medical institutions in the state, not just the state, but the country, really. Mm-hmm. And after Roe was overturned, the message that Johnson was getting from doctors was, I'm out of here. A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge with the prospect of a very substantial prison sentence and a fine of at least $100,000 and the loss of a medical license. So you can imagine that doctors were pretty much weighing in their own livelihood against their patients at this point. Older doctors were considering early retirement. Young.
Some would leave the state too, right?
Absolutely. Anecdotally, we have heard that a great number of physicians have left the state. And in particular, among younger physicians, you know, who were right at the moment where they were considering whether to even begin a practice in Texas, it was easy for them to say, I'm just not going to do this, right? I'm not going to expose myself to this criminal and civil liability that comes with the law.
Let's listen to a little of your conversation with Ann Johnson.
There's just a differing perspective on what choice means, as I meant.
Yeah.
I would talk to a pro-life person. I would give them a complicated moral scenario, and they'd go, well, that's not an abortion.
Mm.
Actually, it is.
Yeah.
Right? the fact that they have the ability in their head to say, no, I see a distinction,
yeah,
right, when posed with the risk.
For conservative members in the House, abortion meant termination of a healthy pregnancy. And when Johnson would come up to them with conditions like a premature rupture of membrane, which is a fairly common complication of pregnancy that doctors talked to her a great deal about, they would say, well, that's not an abortion, right? So there was a question of semantics there that needed to be addressed. What a lot of the doctors have been saying, and women have publicly said too, is that the language is so vague and the penalties for doctors are so steep. And it's been widely documented that doctors and hospitals and administrators and lawyers within those hospitals have been either delaying or denying care to women in critical conditions.
So you've been reporting on a law in Texas that was created because of this reality, because of situations like this, and this was a bipartisan effort. So what does this law do and what does it not do?
The law is what's called an affirmative defense. And I'll give you a little bit of background on this. Before Johnson took office, she served as a chief prosecutor in the Harris County District Attorney's Office. And during her time in the DA's office, she was representing human trafficking victims who had faced prostitution convictions. And in many of these cases, she promoted an affirmative defense, which allowed courts to essentially limit the culpability of these women who had been coerced into committing these offenses.
So, again, our whole goal here was not to use the language that could blow up politically.
Yeah.
And as a lawyer, and being in criminal law, for me, that's where this came from, mm-hmm. which was, what if we create a similar avenue for the doctors? Just in the same way we created for human trafficking victims. Yes, you engaged in prostitution, but you did it because, which is the defense. So we created the same thing for the physicians in this respect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the goal was to take off the handcuffs that were being, one, personal, which was criminal.
Yeah.
Right? They really felt that. Mm. I could go to prison for a minimum of 5 years.
Yeah.
The financial, which is normally a first-degree felony is a maximum $10,000 fine, mm. but they changed the law to say a minimum of $100,000. So they very purposely told the doctors, I'm going to get you both personally and financially.
And it occurred to Johnson that if lawmakers created specific exemptions in the law, then doctors who got sued could show that the treatment that they had offered their patients was compliant with the language of the law. So in other mm-hmm. words, they could say, you know, I provided this care, but I did it because it was reasonable and medical judgment. And a lot of lawmakers, conservative lawmakers, were deeply distrustful of doctors. They didn't trust them. They didn't trust their motives. And this dates back to the pandemic and all the issues around the vaccines and stuff. And so she got her team to reach out to women who had been directly affected by the bans.
What was she able to learn?
She met, for instance, with a 32-year-old woman who had had a premature rupture. So her water essentially broke mm-hmm. at 16 weeks. And the baby was, of course, weeks from viability, and she was at risk of developing an infection. When she got to the hospital, the doctors told her that there was nothing that they could do for her unless she developed a life-threatening condition. And within days, she went into labor, delivered a baby who died within minutes, and she developed a placental infection.
Which is something that never would have happened with Roe in place.
Never.
Steph, something really interesting about Johnson, who of course is a Democrat, ended up working with a state senator named Brian Hughes, who was one of the architects of SB 8, the Texas law that nearly banned abortion before Roe was even overturned. How did that possibly work?
For those who don't know him, Brian Hughes has a reputation of being one of the most conservative senators in Texas. He has championed a series of controversial bills, including a permitless carry bill, a bill that restricts the teaching of critical race theory in schools. But he is best known, really, as the architect of SB 8. Early on, Hughes had written a letter to the Texas Medical Board expressing his concerns about the reports that he was seeing in the press and elsewhere about women being denied life-saving care.
Let's listen to some of your conversation with Brian Hughes.
The consensus was that the folks we talked to, the law is clear. Nevertheless, there are hospitals and doctors and lawyers for hospitals and doctors who are not interpreting the law the way it was drafted. And as a result of that, women are being harmed. So even though we believe the law is clear, we'd like to find a way to clarify it further. And so the dilemma is, how do you do that in a way that provides the clarity necessary, but doesn't have any unintended consequences?
So he's talking about the unintended consequences of this legislation. What is he talking about there?
I think if you were to ask him why he did this, he would tell you that he's generally concerned about women and that the intention of the law was never to harm them. One of the things that he mentioned was that at the time when he started talking to Johnson about this, he heard from pretty influential donors who were concerned about this. And one of them reached out to him and said, you know, my wife's really concerned about this. And I heard that there might be a way that you could address this. And I really hope you do that. So I think it would be naive for us to think that he wasn't considering those concerns, that he wasn't looking at the polls. A growing number of Texans would like to see the laws in, around abortion be less strict. About half of Texans say that. And so I think all of those factors came into play here.
Now, you have two lawmakers who are on diametrically opposed ideological sides and on a very divisive issue. And then they end up co-sponsoring a bill together. Describe what the bill is and what is their relationship now.
So HB 3058 is essentially allowing doctors to intervene in cases of premature ruptures and ectopic pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
So cases, for instance, like Amanda Zorosky's. She suffered a premature rupture at 18 weeks, but doctors wouldn't offer her an abortion because they could still detect a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
She was sent home and ended up developing infections that permanently damaged one of her fallopian tubes. In March of last year, Zorosky became the first woman to file a suit against the state of Texas after being denied an abortion. And there are now 22 plaintiffs in her case. And what Johnson is essentially saying is that a woman in her situation today would be able to access life-saving treatment.
For Johnson, this is a very limited victory. And for the women of the state of Texas, this is a very limited victory. What does Ann Johnson think about the prospects for widening that victory, for expanding it?
I think Johnson is hopeful that more can be done come January of 2025, which is when the legislature will be meeting again.
What's the next battle?
An exception and further clarification of the law.
What does that mean?
Essentially allowing doctors to practice their medical judgment freely, as they did before the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And I think the reason why she's also hopeful is because this was a pretty unconventional bipartisan coalition.
In Texas legislative history, it doesn't happen very often.
It really doesn't.
No,
doesn't.
Notoriously.
And on Hughes' side, he is in close touch with the Texas Medical Board. And what he told us on the record was that he is watching the bill's implementation very, very closely, and that he is hoping that it will resolve some of the ambiguities.
Do you think that was just a kind of one-off situation in Texas, or could there in fact be a softening of the climate now as abortion laws run into the reality of what's going on there and across the country?
I think there's a recognition on both parts that more needs to be done. The way that this was designed, Hughes essentially asked Johnson to put together a list of conditions that would be included into the law. And Johnson was able to put together a list of 13 conditions that dwindled down to two, ectopic pregnancies and premature ruptures. And what we know is that women on a daily basis are exposed to and suffer all sorts of pregnancy-related complications that are not limited to those two. Johnson was in a difficult position because she could either have walked away from that compromise, or she could have accepted it as a first step. You know, she's playing the long game here. And she's looking at the other side, and she's seeing that people who are anti-abortion, it took 50 years for them to overturn Roe v. Wade. And so I think she definitely wants to do more, but she's operating under a very restrictive climate in Texas. And for Hughes, he has personally told me that he is watching the law's implementation and is hoping that it will resolve some of the ambiguities that it's hoping to address, but that he is willing to do more.
Right. But this new law provides the clarifications that are tiny in number, tiny. You talked with an OBGYN named Todd Ivey, who spoke about what it's been like to practice medicine under SB-8. And I have to say, he sounds pretty distraught with the situation.
Until you, right, sat in a room with a woman who has recurrent metastatic breast cancer, you know, who's having her treatments delayed because she's pregnant, okay, or treatment plan altered because she's pregnant, okay? Until you're in a room speaking to a family whose wife or who the matriarch in this family has a recurrent brain tumor in her brain stem and can't access services because she's early pregnant. Until you walk into an exam room and there's a mother who brings her 11-year-old daughter, all right, who was molested by the grandfathers and is pregnant, all right, until you walk into an emergency room and you see, or even in your office, a college girl who's been raped and hasn't told to anybody, you know, until you're in the, and may find yourself pregnant, until you are in those situations, right, and until you are on the ground working with those things and handling those issues, whether I agree that decision or not is irrelevant. Right. But I do not need a politician in my exam room looking over my shoulder telling me the right thing to do medically.
It is incredibly powerful to hear that. Is there any political movement in the state of Texas on the larger issue about overturning abortion restrictions? Because it was very interesting to me to listen to Joe Biden at the State of the Union address say overtly that one of the goals of a second term for him would be to somehow find a way to get the Senate and the House to uphold abortion laws in the future as a matter of legislation rather than as a Supreme Court decision.
I think the reality is that there isn't at this time. You know, there are a series of suits, Amanda Zdrosky's being one of them, Kate Cox's being the second suit that was filed by a woman who faced a pregnancy-related complication. Her fetus was diagnosed with a severe fetal anomaly, trisomy 18. And these are two women who have come forth and sued the state of Texas, right? And so what they're asking for is broader than what HB 3058 does, to let doctors practice medicine freely. And I think, to me, the biggest question is, as you said, this is modest progress. Our reporting has shown that women have died after being denied life-saving care. So the question is, what needs to happen? And how much longer will women have to wait in order for something to actually change?
Steph, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Stephania Talladreed on the fight to restore abortion rights in Texas at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're joined now by Vincent Cunningham, staff writer at The New Yorker. And Vincent, if you want to know what's interesting to read or what plays to see, what to watch, he's somebody you want to hear from. Here's Vincent Cunningham.
I wanted to talk to Jen Silverman because, you know, in my capacity as a theater critic, I encountered this lovely play of theirs. It's called Spain. And it's about two filmmakers who are sort of covertly Russian propagandists. And I thought it was so interesting and politically astute and funny in a way that I just kind of wanted to check out anything they had done. And I was so excited because in addition to being a playwright, Jen also writes novels. And they've just written a new novel. It's called There's Going to Be Trouble. And There's Going to Be Trouble takes place on two timelines. One is closer to the present. It's 2018, and a teacher finds herself sort of in the middle of the Gilets Jaunes protests in France. You may remember the truck drivers and the yellow vests upset about oil prices and cost of living, economic inequality in France.
It is one of the simplest and here in France commonest items of clothing to be found. The high visibility jacket or gilet jaune in French, yellow vest, obligatory here in France to have in your car in case you break down or have an accident. And yet it became, well, a real symbol of defiance against the authorities and president.
And then in 1968, we have a group of students who are leading protests at Harvard University.
These are members of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. They demand an end to reserve officer training on the Harvard campus and an end to Harvard expansion into surrounding neighborhoods in Cambridge. This is the beginning of a crisis at Harvard, and this is the battle cry.
How do you place human drama, things like romance and desire and personal hopes, how do you set that against history that we all remember? You know, how do you set that against the backdrop of politics? And Jen has so closely intermingled these things, made one thing sort of flow out of the other, and I knew that we had to talk.
Here's staff writer Vincent Cunningham talking with playwright and novelist Jen Silverman.
Jen, it's so cool to have you here to talk about your book, There's Going to Be Trouble, which is like, to me, that's like a title that every novel should kind of have. Like, it's the promise of the novel, of anything narrative, is like, there's going to be some trouble here. I love the sort of eventuality in the rhythm of that title. But the fact is, the trouble starts, like, immediately in this book. And more precisely, it starts in 2018, the Gilets Jaunes moment in Paris. Could you talk a little bit about just that setting, and then also the sort of the challenges of writing about moments of protest.
Yes. I was actually in Paris in 2018 at the beginning of the Gilets Jaunes protests, which then, of course, continued and have changed and evolved. And I sort of stumbled into a protest by accident before I really understood what was going on. And I will say it took me a long time and research for this novel to even have a slightly better sense of what was going on.
That's right.
And then, to my fascination, there were so many different kinds of people around me. There were professors and there were truck drivers. There were so many women. And I had not at that point, and again, this is 2018 and a lot changed in America after that as well, but I had not at that point been at a protest that felt so full of people from different class backgrounds, different, you know, trades, different approaches, and they all sort of wanted the same thing. And then my question was, well, what is it that people are here for? Mm-hmm. You know, and then, of course, there's a moment where things turned and it started to get, you know, the police showed up looking like an army and there were sort of vehicles rolling down the street that were military looking. And there was a moment where the energy changed and it suddenly started feeling quite dangerous. And it was out of that that I had been thinking about these questions of protest and revolution and what do we do when we find ourselves in a moment where you start to ask, are things changing? Could they change? Is this just a different point in the endless cycle of non-change?
Right.
That experience of being there and then my curiosity about it started to feed what became the book.
Yeah. One of your lead characters, I like her so much, her name is Minnow. And she, at a dinner party, and she's talking about the brilliance of the protest is its openness to all sort of different kinds of interpretations. But, of course, the problem with that is a kind of legibility, right? That, like, and I think this was a befuddling from America.
Yes.
You know, is this a sort of progressive anti-Macronism? Is this something that seems a bit more like what we are experiencing with Trump? How did you, Jen, in real life, sort of parse through that?
Yes. It is, well, it is the multifaceted nature of it, the sort of shape-shifting quality that was so mesmerizing to me. And I should say, I think the question of how people who think of themselves as apolitical people get pulled into a vibrant political context. When we talk about politics, it's so easy to think that we're talking about ideologies and strategies and intellectual, you know, analysis, and often we are. But the part that fascinates me most is what's under that, that we get pulled into political contexts because we have desire, we have ambition, we have fear, we fall in love with someone, you know, like Minnow, who is in every way an outsider and who up until recently, I mean, she flees to Paris because she gets sort of unwittingly pulled into this political upheaval in her small town in America.
That's right.
Like, she has thought of herself for so long, I think, as a bystander. Mm-hmm. And then she's at this dinner party because she has started to conduct an affair with this younger man who is an activist. And it is through that context that she's trying to understand what the invitation is. And so when you say that there is, when I say invitation, I mean the sort of invitation that the Gilets Jaunes are offering with their lack of legibility.
That's right.
And so that was the invitation for Minnow that I really wanted to explore, is how she chooses what she wants to hear and then moves toward that thing.
Yeah. There's a great passage in this book very early on that just honestly just reminds me of the past. Like, I thought a lot about 2020 and the Black Lives Matter protests and COVID and the upheavals then. Minnow gets caught up in a protest. She doesn't totally know what it is. She sees a guy from work, Charles. Somehow, things get more physical and violent than she realized a protest like this would. And Charles and his friend come and, like, they run away. It's just, like, this awesome, like, passage of action. They, like, sort of are running through side streets getting away from all this. And Minnow is, like, breathing super hard. And she realizes that amid, like, all the fear and everything else that she's feeling, there's also a kind of, like, ecstasy that she's feeling. And this, to me, seems such a generous admission and also, like, dangerous material. Usually when we talk about activism, we don't talk about the pure pleasure that you get from something that is, of course, so, like, adrenaline-inducing. Later on, there's a, you know, in the 1968 timeline, there's, you know, a young man who gets behind a bullhorn for the first time and realizes his sort of rhetorical power. I think it's what some of us fear about protest.
Yes.
Where does that sit with you? On some level, the book is about many things, but it's on some level about the gratifications of being part of a crowd.
Yeah.
And so how did you think your way into that?
I find crowds terrifying and fascinating.
Yeah.
I love people. I love individual people. I love strangers and talking to strangers. The minute there are more than four people present in any space, it's like this, often like a single organism starts to function in a way that is atavistic and instinctual. And we become often different people inside those spaces than we would be when we're alone.
Yeah.
And so I think I have a deep, deep distrust of large groups of people.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I work in the theater. You work in the theater.
Yeah.
I think of, often, not always, I think of protests or sort of staged activist events as inherently theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think theater is an, I've used this word before, but it's an invitation to an audience to enter a space, to sit together, to breathe together, to receive together,
mm-hmm.
to get some kind of spiritual electric charge and then to leave that space. Those who have received it, not everyone will, of course, you know.
Right.
And so when I think about protest through that lens, it makes an inherent sense to me. And when I have been at protests both in the States and then ultimately in Paris, there is a way in which I feel it hit my body like a piece of theater, which is not to say it's false or fake, but rather there is an intellectual thing happening. And then there is also, as you said, a deeply visceral, emotional, embodied
yeah.
thing
yeah.
yeah, that's happening.
Well, I mean, the part of me that was combing your fiction for ideas about your theater making laughed when at an early protest in this book, there's like puppets. It's like that. Okay, yeah.
Yes, yeah. There were 4 to 5 paragraphs about those puppets. And my editor was like, we need one. She was like, I know you're really interested in puppets, but I guarantee nobody else is. But she said it nicely.
Can I ask a craft question in terms of all this, what we've been talking about? In this book, there are many great parties, you know, house party ragers in 68, genteel bourgeois dinner party arguments in 2018. How much is a party like a protest and how you write it?
I had not thought about that until you said it. And I love that comparison because I actually think it's very true.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's that the constant tension between the group and the individual.
Yeah.
And those tensions fascinate me.
Mm-hmm.
And the question also in both a protest and a party of how we present ourselves, how we perform ourselves, a kind mm-hmm. of a persona. And so at the moment that you mentioned from 68, where the character Keane speaks into a bullhorn for the first time and the whole crowd loves him.
Yeah.
It changes for him the way he sees himself and what he thinks he is capable of. And then when later that night he goes to the party that essentially becomes a celebration of him and what he did
yeah.
at this protest crowd event, he has a different way of manifesting who he is in that group of people, a different way of being seen because he's now able to see himself slightly differently. And then I should also say both my parents were at Harvard during that time.
Okay.
My dad was a physics grad student. He's a mm-hmm. physicist. My mom was a chemistry grad student.
Okay.
And the experiment that we meet Keane trying to solve, that was my mom's experiment.
Really?
I made her explain it to me because I am raised by two scientists. I do not have a brain for science and numbers
wow.
in any way. But both my parents, they have this real passion for science. And when they describe what any experiment is or what it is meant to do, there's a narrative to it. And so I've always found it fascinating to listen to them talk about, you know, this field for which they have the kind of passion that I have for the arts.
One of your scientist characters, again, this like young guy Keane, who I think is so not to like pun, but so keenly drawn. He is a scientist whose father is a preacher.
Yes.
He's talking about the sort of structure of his father's worldview. And I think this is the worldview is like on some level also the problem in this book, because it's like that's the thing that you cannot change. That's the thing that will follow you across the ocean or whatever, follow you from religion to science. It will just like stay with you. So he's talking about his father and he says, quote, "And when you receive the world as a masterpiece, you see what's beautiful first and what's horrifying afterwards. And everything that's horrifying can feel like an aberration. The devil at work disrupting God's plan, end quote. So this like thing of like, the world is beautiful, and therefore anything that mars this sort of composition by God, this divine painting, is something that we can sort of hammer out in the same way that one hammers sin out of a personality or something like that. I read that and I felt like, I felt attacked. I think that's how I actually kind of see the world. And I was thinking that people that tell stories have to decide on how they actually see the world, where they think the source of trouble is, whether they think trouble is fundamental or goodness is fundamental.
Yes.
Does writing this like reveal some of that about yourself to you?
Yes. Well, it made me confront the real dichotomy that I think I'm constantly trying to navigate, which is intellectually, the trouble is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But then every time I'm always sort of emotionally surprised when I encounter how terrible things can be or how cruel an individual can be to another individual. There's a way in which my brain says I knew it, but everything in my body is surprised.
Yeah. One similarity that struck me between this book and your last book, We Play Ourselves, is that the protagonists have secrets or incidents in their past that not only belong to, like, chronologically the past, but to another place.
Yes.
You know? I just wondered how you think about, like, how our past, maybe this is just a question about storytelling, how our past, how our recent past conditions how we live in the present.
It's a question that I really wrestle with a lot.
Yeah.
And I think in my 20s, I had this idea, probably because of the way that I first was raised and then raised myself moving from place to place. I had this idea that you can switch countries, you can switch cities, you can, and when you do that, you get to switch lives. You just start over.
You have to change.
You change. Yeah, change. It's
That's
so easy.
That's the promise.
That's the promise.
And of it's travel, of relocation, of migration, right? Like,
yes.
This is the big thing is you can be new.
And it's seductive, the transformation, you know, that is just waiting for you around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you get a little bit older and you realize, like, everywhere you go, you just bring yourself. You know, I'm not the first person who said that. And what became, I think, narratively, and what is now narratively really interesting to me, is, I almost want to say, the failure of transformation, except that I'm never quite sure if it is a failure, but the promise that is just out of reach. Like, I haven't changed yet, but...
Yeah.
What would it take for me to change? And
I'm
fascinated by this, the ways in which individuals seek to change and all of the ways in which we try to escape ourselves. And then, of course, the ways in which communities try to change and the many, many failures and attempts and small successes inherent in that.
I can't even realize my, like, easiest duty. Like, I just, like, want to be a guy who drinks green juices or whatever. And I can't even, I can't accomplish that. So it's like, I'm also going to change the world? Like, what?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going to jet us back to this text. Some of the most interesting arguments in this book are about, like, how to see Emmanuel Macron. I don't know how to see him. He's such an interesting world leader. And most of the time, I'm irritated at the things he does, to put it most lightly. But I don't know. There's something about him. Did you develop a theory of Macron?
I did not. But what fascinates me about him and what I think contributes to the polarization is his charisma. When you have that kind of charisma in a political leader, in a religious leader, in an activist, there's a way in which people respond to the charisma before they even respond to what the person is saying.
Yeah.
And I think that has worked for him and that it has, of course, worked against him. But again, when we were talking about sort of the ambiguities of the Gilets Jaunes movement and how we read ourselves into those ambiguities, what interests me most about Macron's is how people are reading themselves into and against him.
Yeah.
Because he's hard to pin down. I don't know how to pin him down.
Yeah. You know, he's far, far in the background of this novel. It's not like it's a sort of any sort of excavation into him personally. But it just, your sort of almost like sociological description of the many possible ways into this movement made me think about how a charismatic leader, the same way they can form great coalitions on their behalf, can form interesting coalitions against them or something like that, you know?
Yes, and then the tension there, of course, this is 2018, Trump is our president at that time.
Yeah.
And Minow is sort of coming into this context with, like, your president is well-dressed and articulate and seems to be a bit of a humanist. Like, what are you all so mad about?
Yeah.
And I think the book itself is really invested in these characters who are in contexts that they don't understand, come to understand, perhaps misunderstand,
mm-hmm.
without necessarily trying to tell the audience, this is the political ideology that you should embrace. This is the answer.
Right.
This is what will give us change. This is who these political people are. Like, that sort of escapes me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to lie, which is a funny thing to say in fiction, but.
That's right. Jen, this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much for this book, and thank you so much for coming to talk to me. This has been great.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Jen Silverman's new novel is There's Going to Be Trouble. Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer, and you can hear him talking with his colleagues every week about what's happening in the culture on our podcast, Critics at Large. Maya Hawke is best known for her role in Stranger Things. She plays the role of Robin, the band geek who plays French horn. But in real life, the actor is a very different kind of musician.
She's stretching out her sore shoulder.
Back in a moment with Maya Hawke. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
She's wishing she was older, dreaming of an Appaloosa, saddled up, riding out of town. Dreaming of a Shelby Cobra, digging her tires in the ground.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Lucy, is that right?
Yeah.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Lucy wants to write the next great American novel. She can't even read the bottle.
Maya Hawke broke out as an actor 5 years ago in the cast of Stranger Things. And since then, she seems to be everywhere, including last year's Asteroid City and Maestro. But she's also a musician, and that's no little side project for her. Her debut was praised in Pitchfork, and Maya Hawke is about to release her third album. It's called Chaos Angel. Staff writer Rachel Syme caught up with her at rehearsal.
Lucy wants to write the next great American novel. She can't even read the bottle.
I wanted to talk to Maya because I think she is one of the most interesting young performers working today and a true kind of artistic polymath. It's been a huge chunk of her life being on Stranger Things, especially, well, the pandemic took a chunk out of it. But she has been on that show since she was 19 years old and she's now 25. And at the same time, she is a musician on her third record. So she's doing so many different things on so many different levels that I find that really interesting as a model for a young person's career right now in Hollywood.
So you're here rehearsing, and then the day after you fly back down to Atlanta?
I was supposed to be the day after, but their schedule is constantly changing. So now I'm going to fly back on Friday.
But either way, you're going back to the set of Stranger Things.
I am going back to the set of Stranger Things.
Is that a little bit of whiplash for you to sort of code switch between the music and the acting? Or do you find there's a fluidity between the two things? Or how do you sort of put your different hats on?
Yeah. Is it whiplash? No, not for me. Because I really feel like it all comes from the same place in me. Like, my desire to be a good team player is huge in me. And I feel like I'm on a team here in this room working on this song. And I feel like I'm on a team when I'm on the set of Stranger Things. And the part I'm playing is different, but the energy to which I go into that is really similar. So I don't feel whiplash. The only thing that feels like whiplash is, like, after we do this rehearsal and everyone's ready, it's like, ooh, I just want to go on tour. Like, it's almost more of a letdown than a whiplash. It's like, ooh, I feel ready to, like, cook something up and express this thing. And I want to go do it. And now I'm not, and I'm going to go back and, like, put that on pause and refrigerate it for a while. But I felt the same thing leaving Stranger Things. So I was like, wait, oh, no, I don't want to go back to the city now. I've got a good hit on this monologue for next week, and I want to get it right. You know, it's always, you know, interruptions are hard.
So now you're a front woman. You have been for some time, but you're about to, you know, go on tour soon in the year.
Do you feel like you inhabit a character as the musician, Maya? Like, when you're doing this, do you feel like you're like, now I'm Mick Jagger, now I'm rock star me?
No. I feel like I'm me. And when I'm acting, I inhabit the character that I'm playing. But sometimes I have to like screw my courage to the sticking place. And that's a bit of a character, which, like, in that it's me who is willing to stand up on stage and try to make small talk with strangers and try to sing songs, which is me a little bit more courageous than I feel. But it's still just me. It's like just me being like, okay, let's go into battle, you know?
What is your take on sort of performing as a musician in front of a crowd? Is there a certain kind of character that you inhabit when you do it? Do you have to get yourself in a certain mental state to sort of be up there?
I'm still learning. I feel like partly why I played guitar at Carnegie last night, and that I've been practicing a lot, and I want to play more of my songs on stage, even though I work with some of the best guitar players, I think, in the world. But even if it's not actually contributing, it's inspiring for young girls to see a girl stand on stage and hold an instrument. And even if I'm playing badly, it's like, it's, I don't know, that feels like it matters. Mattered to me when I saw it. Mm. Mattered to me a lot. And so there's that. And then there's also, it saves you a lot of trouble with figuring out what to do with your body. Finding my own relationship to my body on stage has been a real journey. I've generally not been a person who's that comfortable in their body. I think I used to exercise and eat only to get smaller, like so many women. And then I started understanding that actually I could exercise and eat to raise my capacity for movement, my flexibility, my strength, my energy. So I'm a late to the game of getting to know my body. But actually, weirdly, I performed on Fallon in 2023, and the tour I went on that led up to that performance was the tour where I figured out how I want to move my body. So it's like very hands forward and a little bit like I'm crazy, but in a sort of, I don't know, my own way. But yeah, so you could see it in that performance, I think, is like where I'm working from and what I'm working towards.
Can we talk about a couple specific songs on the record?
Duh.
So Missing Out, you're going to be singing. Can you tell me about the story of that song?
Yeah, I was unemployed, and I went to go. I started really wanting to hang out with my brother at college because I never went to college, and I kind of wanted. I missed him, and I wanted to see what the vibe was. And it was a really emotional experience for me because I had a real chip on my shoulder about having not gone into any colleges and not really wanting to have gone, but then kind of missing out on the connection to your generation that you have, which there is where the title comes from. Like kind of missing out on your own generation, basically, and instead kind of skipping into this adult world that is great and that I love, but was sort of like, oh, well, did I skip a step? Did I skip a big step? And so I put in a little time and I snuck into some classes and I went to some parties and I don't know. I think it healed whatever that thing was in me and made me see what it was that was great, what it was that I actually liked about my own life, and that was really interesting and cool.
Did it make you feel in the end like you're like, yeah, I'm good. I feel like I didn't. It's good that I didn't do this. Or
yeah. Or not good that I didn't, but I'm okay with my path.
What are a few lines from the song that are sort of your favorites or that you feel like are emblematic of that the process, the writing process?
So I like those lines a lot. I also am extremely proud of the first line, Lucy wants to write the next great American novel. Because when I was in high school, I really feel like I felt that way. Like, I want to do something great. I want to do something amazing. But kind of how I got to the point where I was like, oh, I'm actually happy with my life is by hearing someone in this social circle that I was visiting say that, I want to write the next great American novel, and me being like, that's not what you want. You want to write a novel. Start with a novel. Maybe a novel about fill in the blank. Like a novel about my relationship with scissors. Like whatever, you know, fill in the blank. And get specific, get personal, like get to work. And worry. Don't worry about how it will be received. Like the word great is like, that's what other people think. That's not what you think. And so that was a big epiphany for me where I was like, oh, cool. Yes, that's what I want. Okay, let's get back on the road, you know?
Cut us, Betty. One, two.
Maya Hawke's album Chaos Angel comes out later this spring. She spoke to The New Yorker's Rachel Sahn. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Lucy wants to write the next great American novel. The bottle. She says, I might be a genius. Well, she could be a model. Didn't think I'd get in, so I didn't apply. Now I'm a drunk hanger-on, hitting on a younger guy. Buy a boost for the Ivy League with my television salary. Think they look up to me, huh? Well, I was left like coals and leaves, and I sparked up.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Paula Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, Jared Paul, and Alicia Zuckerman, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Before I skip the fundamentals, before I ran from safety, hoping someone would chase me, I was left like coals in leaves, and I sparked up in winter's breeze, and now I know it's me who's missing out, missing out, missing out, missing out. Missing out, missing out, missing out, missing out, missing out, missing out. Now I know it's me who's missing out. Missing out, 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 missing out. Now I know it's me.